And then I'm guaranteed to have these all add up to one. So these are sure measures. So I guess this definition in this form is due to Okunkov in 2000. So the sure measures have this fairly nice property that they define what's now called a determinantal point process. Determinantal point process. What this means is the following, that if I draw my partition in the following way, this is called the Young diagram of a partition. So this will be, so this picture is drawn on a lattice, and this length here is lambda one. Then the next one is lambda two, and so on. The final one is lambda n. Then if I take this picture, so one can think of it as being inside a quadrant. Somehow quadrant plays many different roles in my talk today. And then if I look at all middles of the edges of slope one, and then if I project this on the horizontal line, I get a point configuration. It's going to be random. It's just a way to parameterize my partition. And so the property, so let me call it something, I don't know. Let me call it C, point configuration. So the determinantal point process means that if I want to evaluate the probability that a few points are inside my point configuration C, these are the so-called correlation functions, then this probability can be written as a neat determinant. And then the kernel K that goes to inside it is explicit. This is very useful. It's very rare that one can evaluate so many correlation functions so explicitly. And in particular, it is this structure that made it possible to get to the Tracy-Widom distribution in most cases where it was proved. So what's distributed here according to the Tracy-Widom distribution? It's the end point, this point here. When the picture becomes large, you can imagine that the parameter n here gets large, then this point here in the limit will fluctuate according to the Tracy-Widom distribution. And this is similar to the original way the Tracy-Widom distribution showed up as the largest eigenvalue of random matrices. You can see that this edge point plays the role of the largest eigenvalue somehow, or the smallest eigenvalue, something like that. Okay, now, so I tried to draw the six vertex model and the sure measures on two different halves of my picture. So the sure measures are very algebraic. They have these nice determinantal formulas that allow one to analyze them and so on. But they are complicated from the point of view of a probabilist. Why would you want to study such a involved object? On the other hand, the six vertex model on the left here, it's easily defined. You just flip coins every time the paths cross the vertices of the lattice. It would be nice to understand its Lachenaie nine behavior, but it's hard to do it. And so between them, there is sort of a miraculous connection. So let me state here theorem. So the connection is the following, that if I compute the expectation with respect to my stochastic six vertex model, of a certain observable that depends on the value of the height function at a particular point. So the observable is a number, is always between 0 and 1, and it's the infinite product of the following thing. So this is key, right? I should have added the definition. So 1 second. This is plus I. So zeta here, this is an arbitrary parameter. So this is generic. Just a formal variable, if you wish. Now, what is T? So the six vertex model is defined in terms of two deltas, delta one and delta two. So these two deltas need to be connected to T in some way, where T is the same as the parameter I started with. And so the connection is by basically just changing the variable. So the delta one and delta two, their ratio is T. And then in order to state an exact thing, an exact theorem, I need to reparametrize delta one in terms of variables that depend on rows and columns. So I have two sequences of parameters called C and U. One of them depends on the rows of my model, so just an integer coordinate across the quadrant, and the other one depends on the columns of the model. Right. So the expectation of a six vertex model of this object is equal to the expectation over the Schur measure of another infinite product. And so that infinite product is the product over all points of my point configuration here, so that I denoted by red, of something that looks slightly similar, 1 plus zeta t to the power c. This is sort of a magic identity that connects the two models, and it really allows to move the information from the algebraic object in which things are nice and computable to the probabilistic object where one wants to get the limiting theorems. So when t is between 0 and 1, what happens is that you know, if you look at this expectation, you look at this t to the c over here. And so this is a quantity that changes, that quickly changes between 0 and 1. You know, if c is increasing, then t to the power c decays quickly. And so what happens is that this whole product is actually going to pick up the distribution function of the largest, well, in this case, of the smallest point of my configuration C. And it will produce the Tracy-Witten type behavior. And that's the reason that the height function here will have the Tracy-Witten type asymptotics. And that goes back to my theorem one, where I claimed Tracy-Witten asymptotics for the polynuclear growth model. On the other hand, when t goes to 1, what will happen is that this product will have a different type of behavior. It will actually converge to a similar product, which will involve not just the smallest point of my point configuration, but it will involve the whole tail that lives at the edge of my partition. So this whole tail of which Tracy-Witten is the edge is called the airy process and the airy point process in the limit, AI. And so here one will observe something like the exponential with some other constant, I don't know, beta, and then ai, the product over I. And it's this behavior that encodes the solution of the KPZ and the stochastic heat equation. Okay. And it's that convergence of the product that's responsible for the second theorem, the convergence of the solution of the stochastic heat equation. And all those scary scaling constants, you know, the powers of -3 and the log and so on, they all show up in the scaling limit on the edge of the partitions over here, which is a common computation for random matrices and for random partitions over there. I think my time is coming to a close, and I think that this is roughly where I want to stop now. I tried to to show that algebra is really helpful in trying to analyze large time asymptotics of important and simple looking probabilistic models. And not only it allows to get asymptotics of them, but it also allows to see connections between probabilistic models that are not visible from the very beginning. By going into the more abstract algebraic framework, one can actually, it's sort of like climbing a hill. Once you climb the hill, you can look left and you can look right, and you see different scenery, but you know that you can descend from the hill into both of them and relate them between each other. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for hosting me in this conference. And let me echo Greg and thank the organizers for this very interesting event that I was able to enjoy online as well. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. That was a wonderful talk and a strong way to finish the conference. People who are remote, if you want to ask a question, you can ask or say something in the, yeah, thank you, C, for pointing out the chat can be used. We'll also certainly take questions from the audience here. I have one that I would be happy to start with because it's relatively simple, perhaps. In your theorem one, the right-hand side, the Tracy-Widom distribution, you don't see the parameter t at all. Is that just because the intensity of the Poisson point process is 1 minus t, so the t dependence is sort of sucked into the normalization, or?
No. So the dependence of t, the intensity of 1 minus t is responsible for having these constants in the statement independent of t. So that's where the normalization of the intensity comes from. The fact that the Tracy-Widom distribution itself is independent of T is a deep property of the Tracy-Widom distribution as the universal limit for growth models in a fairly broad universality class. Of course, if you put the constant dependent on t into the numerator here, you know, you can compensate by it by adding it over here. It's the same as in any central limit theorem. But I guess the point that I want to emphasize is that one expects that after proper normalization, one will still end up with the Tracy-Widom distribution and not anything else. You know, potentially scaled, but that scale can always be moved to the left-hand side.
Thank you. Yes.
Very similar question. In the theorem two, was it surprising or was it expected that the limit doesn't depend on the rate at which epsilon goes to zero?
In the theorem two, I increased my volume. Could you repeat the last part of the question? In theorem two, should one expect what?
So in theorem two, it looks like epsilon can go to zero at any rate. Is it surprising or is that expected that it does not depend on the rate at which epsilon decays?
No, epsilon, so Yeah, so epsilon going to zero is really just the statement that we are moving into the quadrant, you know, into the bulk of the picture. The important thing is the connection between the T parameter and the epsilon parameter. So epsilon parameter tells you how fast you're traveling, you're going into the quadrant, right? So your distance from the origin is epsilon to the power minus 3. And the parameter T that's approximately 1 needs to be in exact agreement with that distance. So it's relation between this epsilon to the minus 3 and this e to the power minus epsilon that's important here.
Okay. Further questions from the live side?
I think there is a question on Zoom.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much for the nice talk. I have a question about theorem one.
Yeah.
Theorem one relates to input, which is Poisson in the quadrant. If you replace Poisson input by more general input, can you say anything?
So the answer to that question is that conjecturally, the Dreyse-Witten distribution in the fluctuation limit should be independent of, it might be simpler actually to think about the discrete quadrant rather than the continuous one, and just maybe place those nucleation events according to independent random variables in all the cells of the discrete quadrant. And so then it's natural to ask the exact question is if you consider different distributions on placing those nucleation events at each location, given that the locations are independent, do you expect to see Dreyse-Witten distribution in the limit of fluctuations of the height function? The question is yes, one very much expects that to happen. Whether anybody knows how to prove that, the answer is no. This is quite far from what people can do. For certain classes of distributions, like the Poisson that I use, or the geometric distribution, or the Bernoulli distribution, there is an algebraic framework in the spirit of what I indicated that allows one to prove that Dreyse-Witten distribution. So there is a bunch of cases which are integrable or algebraic in a sense, where one can do it. But doing it in general, you know, I really wish I knew how to answer that. Mm-hmm. It should be there, and it's not so far.
It would make it a very universal theorem.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, everybody expects that to hold, really. Mm-hmm. Except for we have no idea.
Thank you.
Ah, yes, a question in the back. You can try to speak up and I'll repeat it if necessary. The question is, in theorem two, how exactly are we seeing the Gaussian emerging from the scaling limit?
Right. So if you consider, so the KPZ equation or the stochastic heat equation, if you consider it at very large times, then the solution will have Dreyse-Witten fluctuations. So that's convergence to one end. But if you consider it at infinitesimally small time, what you will see is the Gaussian behavior. What will happen is that this product of the solution and the space-time white noise in the infinitesimal time will actually get replaced by maybe the whole right-hand side will get replaced by the second derivative plus the white noise. So it will be the stochastic heat equation with the additive white noise. And that object has Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes as a solution, and that's the Gaussian object. So the Gaussian asymptotics, or the Gaussian behavior, is an infinitesimally small time of the stochastic heap with multiplicative noise. And the Tracy-Whittam is the infinitely large time of that equation.